We're in Isaiah 48. You can go ahead and turn there. And I'm going to write some numbers on the board.
Chapter 48 is the end of a section,
and it kind of helps to think through the book if kind of realize where there are transitions and changes, where he's kind of wrapping up one area and moving on to the next. We've talked, I don't focus on this a whole lot, but we've talked somewhat briefly about the big structural division of the book. The first 39 chapters constitute the first section, then the next 27 chapters, the second half. The first 39 chapters I might call, just thinking here off the top of my head, into exile, and then chapters 40 to 66 are, we might think of as beyond exile. This is the Babylonian exile. So in 1 through 39, he's saying, because you're sinful, you're going to be judged. That judgment consists of being taken out of your promised land. I mean, this was the blessing. This was everything they wanted coming out of Egypt. 40 years in the wilderness, and finally they made it to the promised land. Well, God says, time's up. I mean, it's been hundreds of years, but you're going to leave. You're going into exile out of the land. And this section is focused more on what's going to happen after the exile, namely coming back from exile. We see a little bit of that today, but more than that, more than just coming back to the land. You maybe recall some of the smaller sections in the book. I don't want to divide this one here. We'll go with that. I'm not going to spend much time on this, but I'll make this point. Here's the divisions for the second half of the book. So, and that's why I'm doing this, is because today we're here. And then 56 to 66. But if I'm teaching my children how to write an essay or an article or a book, or my students, this would be more, I don't do it so much with my children, too young. But, you know, with the college students, you say, okay, you need to have a thesis statement, then you need to develop it. I want clear organization, you know, point A, support it, point B, support it. Well, Isaiah would have gotten a big rewrite from me. he doesn't do it that way. And you can say that this isn't all about going into exile. It's not all about judgment. Sometimes people, they do, I mean, as I've just done, simplistically say, oh, judgment, first half of the book, comfort, second half of the book. Yes and no, because there's a lot of comfort going on here. I mean, remember all the times we're talking about the Messiah, the King? It's loaded. I just name off all the chapters. It has a reference to the glorious future. It's a thread or threads running through here. Well, here, this is largely concerned with comfort and restoration. But even in today's passage, I mean, he's calling them blockheads and obstinate. You've got foreheads of bronze, and you've got sinews of iron. And I mean, that's not nice things to say. So, I mean, the reality is, in both throughout the whole book, there's judgment and there's hope. And so what do we have here? Just to narrow it in, this section, and I'm gonna, again, I've just explained to you that there's threads going throughout the whole thing. So anything I categorize is already too simple. But this is generally speaking about the physical, I don't want to say physical deliverance or physical salvation, is another word for deliverance, from Babylon with a servant named Cyrus. generally. We'll see, he's going to talk about Cyrus in this chapter today too. But he's ending, chapter 48 isn't just a conclusion to this, as we'll see, but it's also an introduction to this, in which he's going to talk about, again, I'm being a little bit too simple here, but it's generally holds, a spiritual deliverance or a spiritual salvation through a servant whose name is, we don't know, doesn't give us a name.
Jesus.
Yes. Now that's who it's going to be. But he doesn't tell us his name. And it doesn't hold exactly because this servant here has already been introduced in the first section. Specifically in chapter 42. I don't know if you can remember that far back, but I tried to make a big deal about how important the chapter 42 was in what was going to come ahead in introducing this figure. And I will be coming back to it particularly next week, because next week we're going to hit this hard. Well, don't skip next week, because there's a whole song about the servant in chapter 49. And I say it this way. You're more familiar with chapter 53. Everybody knows about Isaiah 53, and because it's quoted a lot in the New Testament, and we get all excited, and I do too, and we're going to plan to spend the whole month of November in chapter 53. But it's better. You'll enjoy it more. I'm certainly enjoying it more by knowing the lead-up. Isaiah didn't write a chapter. He developed it. So 49 gets you ready for 53. 50 gets you ready for 53. So my single point, my primary point I want to get here is that today in chapter 48, we're going to read it right now, is a bit of a transition from the former things to the new things. So maybe we can get a few volunteers if you would like to read.
It seems one of the struggles is that because we think linearly, we keep trying to put over it a linear fit. So we, since we can understand it better that way, when in many ways it's more like a symphony, where you have themes introduced, there's a recurrence of themes, they build, and then they finally come into their full orb. It's a work of art.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And when I said like I would send them back to rewrite it, my point is, right, that it doesn't fit exactly our linear thinking, but if you're this good, I mean, he's already been through that class where he's doing something far greater. And two, here I'm gonna step out just a tad, but I think Isaiah is intentionally, you don't have to believe me, but I think he's intentionally creating some mystery. He could have written, the main essence in three chapters, in point by point. He could have written a theology or a synopsis really simply and really easy. But he's trying to create something grander, partly, I believe, to obscure some truth from those who reject, I think. And I take a cue from chapter 6. So he's not casting his pearls before swine. He's not trying to... He wants the remnant, right, those who believe God, to think hard and to see the glory. And that's part, I mean, for me, in my study of Isaiah, I mean, it's been so enjoyable because of the glory that comes out after some work. If it was just laying on the table, you know, and you, what's the phrase here, but you know, you... Yeah, there's greater enjoyment because of the process. So we have 22 verses. Why don't, and it actually splits really nicely into two parts. So if I could get someone to read 1 through 11, Pam, and then 12 through the end, Cindy.
Listen to this, O house of Jacob. You who are called by the name of Israel and come from the line of Judah, you who take oaths in the name of the Lord and invoke the God of Israel, but not in truth or righteousness, you who call yourselves citizens of the holy city and rely on the God of Israel, the Lord Almighty is his name. I foretold the former things long ago. My mouth announced them, and I made them known. Then suddenly I acted, and they came to pass. For I knew how stubborn you were. The sinews of your neck were iron, your forehead was bronze. Therefore I told you these things long ago, before they happened. I announced them to you, so that you could not say, my idols did them. My wooden image and metal god ordained them. You've heard these things. Look at them all. Will you not admit them? From now on, I will tell you of new things, of hidden things unknown to you. They are created now and not long ago. You have not heard them before today. So you cannot say, yes, I knew of them. For you neither heard nor understood from of old. Your ear has not been open. Well do I know how treacherous you are. You were called a rebel from birth. For my own name's sake, I delay my wrath. For the sake of my praise, I hold it back from you, so as not to cut you off. See, I have refined you, though not as silver. I have tested you in the furnace of affliction. For my own sake, I do this. How can I let myself be defamed? I will not yield my glory to another.
Listen to me, O Jacob, Israel, whom I am summoning. I am the one. I am present at the very beginning and at the very end. Yes, my hand founded the earth. My right hand spread out the sky. I summon them. They stand together. All of you, gather together and listen. Who among them announced these things? The Lord's ally will carry out his desire against Babylon. He will exert his power against the Babylonians. I have spoken. Yes, I have summoned him. I lead him and he will succeed. Approach me. Listen to this. From the very first, I have not spoken in secret. When it happens, I am there. So now the Sovereign Lord has sent me, accompanied by his Spirit. This is what the Lord, your protector, says, the Holy One of Israel. I am the Lord your God, who teaches you how to succeed, who leads you in the way you should go. If only you had obeyed my commandments, prosperity would have flowed to you like a river. Deliverance would have come to you like the waves of the sea. Your descendants would have been as numerous as sand, and your children like its granules. Their name would not have been cut off and eliminated from my presence. Leave Babylon, flee from the Babylonians. Announce it with a shout of joy. Make this known. Proclaim it throughout the earth. Say, the Lord protects his servant Jacob. They do not thirst as he leads them through the dry region. He makes water flow out of a rock for them. He splits open a rock and water flows out. There will be no prosperity for the wicked, says the Lord.
This is a tough chapter to just get a real sense for after reading it through one time, because it seems like there's a number of things going on, and there are. I've divided it, the chapter, into four parts, and I think these are not too difficult to discern. And I want to just look at each section in turn. I entitled the chapter after some struggling here. I had a few different ideas, but I went with former and new things. That was the title I had when I hit the print button anyway. And clearly, there is the sense, I mean, he's talking here about the things I have done. I told you about these things that I would do, and I did them. I'm going to do some new things. So, is that the only main idea of the chapter? I don't know. Certainly, it's certainly a main idea of the chapter. And I think it works well with being a hinge between this section here and then the next. The former things, I'm going to be careful because it's not crystal clear, but it seems real possible that the former things are the things God has talked about with regard to the physical deliverance, and the new things I'm going to do are the things he's going to be talking about in the next few chapters. And let me support that with one observation. You know, if see if this works for you. I told you that these chapters are primarily concerned with a servant, not a named person, but it's the servant, and he's the one who's going to die in order to atone for sin, who's going to be resurrected. This servant is also talked about in chapter 42. And in the context there, it says God speaks about the new things he's going to do. So I see new things and the servant, I think in the new things I'm going to do, is announcing really this servant in the following section. But like I said, there are some things that are... He doesn't come out exactly and say what are the former things. Let's just look at these first 5.5 verses where God says, like in verses 1 and 2, it might throw you off a little bit because you think he's starting off like with a pat on the back for the Israelites. He's saying, "Listen to this, O house of Jacob," and then he defines, "Who is Jacob? Oh, you call yourself by Israel, and you come from the line of Judah, and you take your oath in the name of the Lord." In verse 2, "You call yourself citizens of Jerusalem, and you rely on God." But in the middle there, he says, I mean, you say all of these things, but you don't live it. Not, he says, in truth or righteousness. So, again, this idea that this is the half of the book about judgment, this is the half of the book about covenant, isn't really true, because he still knows the people he's dealing with are sinful. And you, what do you do to sinful people? You don't comfort them. Right? What's the phrase?
1 Thessalonians 5:14, warn the idle, encourage the timid, help the weak.
Yeah, I was thinking there's another thing like afflict. Your job is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comforted. Yeah, is that it? You heard that?
Say it again.
Afflict or comfort the afflicted and afflict the comforted. And it's kind of the role of the prophet or the pastor. So he's not giving comfort to those who persist in their wickedness. In fact, what's the last verse of the chapter? Did that strike you anybody strange? Like, where did that come from? It kind of seems, and that's what some Bible commentators do, they say, oh, this verse, the last verse, verse 22, it doesn't belong here. And it's even repeated at the end of chapter 57. So say, oh, it's a structural device that they just put in there to break this up into parts, and it doesn't really fit. But it does fit. I mean, because the point is, there is comfort. I am going to deliver you. I'm going to bring you out of Babylon. I'm your God. But is that for everybody? There's no peace for the wicked. And if you're wicked and you're persisting in your sin, these blessings aren't for you, is what he's saying. So, well, that was the introduction, the first couple of verses. In the next verse 3 says, "I foretold the former things long ago. My mouth announced them and I made them known. Then suddenly I acted and they came to pass." I don't know. It doesn't say what he's thinking of. It could be everything back to Abraham. You know, like when he predicted Abraham, you're going to go into Egypt and you're going to be held captive there for, does it say how long? I don't remember, just went blank. Like, did he say 400 years or? Anyway, he says, you're going in Egypt, you're going to be captive, I'm going to bring you back. I mean, that could be, I mean, that's one of the former things possibly that he's speaking of. Or it could be something in the more recent past, like Isaiah, you know, something that God spoke through Isaiah. What did God say through Isaiah? What did he predict? He predicted that God would raise up the Assyrians and that they would judge the nation, but that God would deliver them, and that happened. He also predicted that God would raise up the Babylonians, and the Babylonians would take Israel into exile, and of course that hadn't occurred yet when Isaiah wrote this, but in any case, what is crystal clear is that God has revealed the past. He revealed in the past, he revealed the future, and now that's come to be. Now, is that, how is that relevant then if he's going to reveal new things? Right? Are those things just as trustworthy? Verse 6b. Now let's go to the second section, unless any questions on that first part. From 6b on, it says, from now on, I will tell you of new things. So these are things that you haven't heard already. They were hidden to you. Not to God, of course. He knew, he knows everything, but and then verse 7, he says, he emphasizes the point. You didn't know about them. You can't claim you knew about them. This is brand new. And he even speaks in verse 8 to Israel's sinfulness again. So this idea he keeps coming back to is God's doing new things. That doesn't mean they deserve them. God, you know, recognizes their and two, you know what I mean? There should be a real dawning in the mind of the listener. God's going to deliver us, but we don't deserve it. We were sinful. We still are sinful. We need more, and that's what this is about. How God is going to remove their sin. Verses 9 through 11, I just draw your attention to these. It's a little subunit in this chapter. Because he begins with an idea and then he ends with that idea in 9 and 11. And I would just make the point, and this is true for the whole book. It's true for the whole Bible, I believe. That God does what he does for his glory. And if there's one thing that the church needs today, it's a reorienting from the man-centered, God is about me, to God is about God. God works for his glory. Now that doesn't hurt me. That's not like, oh, well, I lose. I don't lose because God works for his glory. Because God is working for his glory, he does things like send his son to die for me. I mean, that brings about my salvation, which brings about God's glory. So, I just think that's an important emphasis that is not as present in our church, in the church of America anyway, today. Well, you have any questions or thoughts? Anything you want to share here on this first part?
I think, Todd, as you were saying, verses 10 and 11, I mean, again, one way that God is glorified and honored, and I won't give my glory to another, is by afflicting us because of our disobedience. He would not be a loving, holy Father if he allowed disobedience to continue uninterrupted.
Well, I was actually going, it's one of my favorite verses too, is 10 and 11. Because, and it kind of hit, I proclaim myself a Christian, which means I'm a son of Christ, you know, a son of God. And yet, you know, so I carry that name. I carry Christ's name into work and into the neighborhood. And yet, I'm sinful. And so, that's what kind of hit in verse 11. I say, when I sin, I profane his name. Mm-hmm. And for that, for his name's sake, he tests me to refine me, to make me more like him. And it's really comforting
it kind of gets into that comfort part, in that I know why I'm afflicted. Mm-hmm. It gives me peace because I know the bigger picture a little bit. Mm-hmm. But the big thing is that God's refining me because he loves me and he wants me to be just like my daddy. Mm-hmm. And that's where that last verse comes in the chapter. Mm-hmm. The wicked don't know peace because they don't know the overall picture. And that's a huge comfort, you know, when, you know, your van breaks down, you can't go to a football game, you know, or you get an infection or something, or, you know, you get afflicted, and it's God's hands there. That's a big comfort.
I would see it this way. I agree with everything you say. I'm just going to go another step. What God is revealing for his, through Isaiah here, is his work with his nation of Israel. Israel, I am going to take you through the furnace. I am going to refine you so that you come out and you can glorify me. The writer of Hebrews is reading this passage and he sees the truth and he applies it to us who are children of our Father who loves us and who disciplines us for his good. So I see there's application in it. I think when we apply it, like to us because of our relationship with our Father, we're doing something similar to what the writer of Hebrews is doing.
Todd, can I ask you a question? I had to go back to verse 1.
I can't go back to verse
1. But it is not in truth nor in righteousness. And I'm trying to understand, what is it we do? How do we apply that? What it's like, okay, you know, I've got to purify you because you don't know the truth. You don't act righteously. I'm trying to understand that a little bit better. What, when God convicts them of that, what's he really saying?
One of the tough things in reading this or other places in Scripture is knowing who he's talking to. Because, just thinking now specifically of Isaiah, his audience includes wicked Israel, the people who don't give a rip about God, who as soon as they get done listening to Isaiah are going to be off to a high place, giving a sacrifice to an idol or whatever. But then there's also in his audience a faithful remnant, true believers who are devoted to God. They're not perfect, but their trust is in the Lord. I think that, you know, here when he says, "Oh, house of Jacob," he's speaking to the larger group that's hypocritical. I have one quote in here that the second. Oh, mine got chopped off. Oh, did all yours get chopped off? The left margin and the inside.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry.
I thought it was a test.
I was figuring it out.
You know, this is the original, and I was running a little bit behind this morning. I just hit the print, and I never even looked to see that it came out. I usually do. But,
so you get an auction on the original that's running.
Here's the other thing. The second quote on the notes, the where it should say V1, verse 1, God has never been greatly impressed with good actors who can play their part, repeat all the right lines, or pretend that they know and deeply love him. That seems to be what's going on here. I see the same thing in like Matthew 23, where Jesus is giving the woes to the Pharisees. He's saying, you're following all these laws. You know, and you claim you're the chosen one of Israel. But you're not following me. Your heart's not right. You see it in Romans 9, where Paul is answering this question, like, did God fail in his promises? And part of the answer is, not all Israel is Israel. Is that Romans 9 or Romans? I was going to look that up this morning. Ran out of time, but the point is, whether that's a direct quote or not, that there's a faithful remnant within Israel. And those who just have the name do not please God. Did that? Okay, so let's look at the second half of this chapter, beginning in verse 12. And the first section here, I think, is the first part of this second half. Verses 12 through 15, I think, is pretty clear. God is going to tell them, this is what I'm going to do. But it's kind of a crazy idea. I mean, God doesn't do anything crazy, but they viewed it as out there. And so, before he even gets to saying that, again, because he said it before, but he just says, you know what, listen to me. This just occurs to me. Can I make this? Is this legitimate? Do you remember when, you of course do, Jesus asks his disciples, who do you say I am? And Peter says, finally, you are the Christ, the Son of God. And then Jesus says, you got it right, I'm going to die. And Peter's like, never, Lord. And Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. And then what happens next? And the next thing is the transfiguration. And what does God say at the transfiguration? He says, this is my son, listen to him. As if to say, hey, Peter, you know, if my son says he's going to die, listen to him. I mean, if there's a hard concept, and that was certainly hard, that seems to be what's going on here. There's a hard idea, listen. You know, even if you don't believe it, if it doesn't make sense, you don't think this is the way I should do it, listen to me. Trust me. And what does he say he's going to... And verse 13, listen to me. I'm the guy who made it all. I made the heavens, I made the earth, and you think you're going to tell me, you know what's better. Right? That reminds you of Job, right? Where, so what is this thing he's doing? The Lord's chosen ally, that's a bit of a paraphrase there, but the idea is that God has chosen somebody who will carry out his purpose against Babylon, his army against the Babylonians. Verse 15, I have spoken, in the beginning of verse 15 is a bit unusual. I didn't look it up to see if it's entirely unique, but he begins with, literally in Hebrew, I, and then the verb, which includes the I again. So it's almost like he says, I have spoken. So this is God's here. I'm going to do this. I have called him. I will bring him. He's going to succeed. So that's 12. Who is this person again? This is Cyrus. It doesn't say it, but I think from the context he's talking about. Now, why is this idea so crazy again? I'll just remind you that Cyrus is going to be, it says in the future, a Persian king. He's not an Israelite. And God calls him his servant. He actually calls him his Messiah, which means anointed one. There's other Messiahs, not only the capital M Messiah, there's other anointed ones of God. And people are going, you're going to use a pagan king? He doesn't know you, he doesn't trust you. God says, oh, you know what I want? And I'm going to use him. Last time I used Moses, this time I'm going to use Cyrus to let you go home. So that's what I'm going to do. Don't talk back. Now, the next section, verses 16 through 22, there's some easy parts and there's some harder parts. Let's start with the harder part. Come near and listen to this, verse 16. From the first announcement, I have not spoken in secret. The time it happens, I am there. And now the sovereign Lord has sent me with his spirit. Now, I did, this came up last week in connection with a question, and I just noted it, but I didn't explain it. This is tough. Who is the me in this verse? And now the sovereign Lord has sent me with his spirit. Here, there's two main options. No, there's three. There's more, but here's the three I'll give you. One is, it's Cyrus who says this. The Persian king is like responding. God says, I'm going to send you, and I'm going to have you accomplish my purpose. And so Cyrus says, oh, the sovereign Lord has sent me with his spirit. There's a couple problems with this view. One is, there's no indication ever that Cyrus ever acknowledged God's work in him. God accomplished his work, but Cyrus didn't recognize who was doing it. The other problem is that there's no indication that the Spirit was upon Cyrus. Okay, so here's a better option. The prophet, Isaiah himself. This would be the most common or popular view among scholars, that Isaiah just breaks in here and says, okay, so God has sent me with his Spirit. And it could be, because the Spirit could be on, I mean, the Spirit certainly was on Isaiah, right, inspiring him, all of this, all of these prophecies. Here's the problem with this view. One, there's no prophet in the immediate context. And two, Isaiah, as a prophet, in this whole section of the book, I say never, I don't know if it's never, but almost never, if not never, speaks in the first person. So if this is Isaiah, who suddenly just breaks out and says, and now the sovereign Lord has sent me, would be unique. Here's a third option. Look in chapter 49, verse 1. In the chapters, we see a chapter break, we go, oh, big division. Like, don't even think about the two together. But, right, they weren't there in the original. I mean, Isaiah just, he went from 48 to 49 without stopping, and there may be some, there is some shifts, but maybe we can make it to be two. We don't want to make it a chasm. Listen to me, you islands. Hear this, you distant lands. This is next week, so I don't want to go too far in it, but I'll tell you the answer. This is agreed upon by all. I, the first person who's speaking in chapter 49, is the servant. Now, who's the servant? Some people want to, we'll talk about that. The answer is Jesus, but not everybody believes that. The servant will, you know, be. So is it possible, here's the thought, is it possible that the spirit, or the servant, starts, I mean, he really actually begins speaking here in chapter 48, verse 16. That's where I'm at right now. And yes, that does, you know, lead to, I don't want to make this to be the main point, but if this is the servant, then what you have here is, and now the sovereign Lord has sent me, the servant, who will be Jesus, with his spirit. That does give you a reference to the Trinity in the Old Testament. The reason why I want to make this your main, you know, proof text is because it is difficult, right? You saw how we got to understanding this. It's, it's by some logic, and it doesn't say it explicitly. I think it's the best choice. Now, that's the tougher part. And to me, it fits in too. I just connect this with this idea of the former things and the new things. The former things are the things God has already talked about, namely, I'm going to bring you out of exile, out of physical exile from Babylon. The new things, I'm going to bring you out of spiritual exile from your sin. And that's, so to me, this section here, this chapter, is a hinge between in the book. Does that make sense? Now look at verses 17 and 18. This will ring a bell for the parents in here who feel like they've said this to their kids before. Verse 18, at least. If only, have you ever said this to your kids? If only you paid attention to my commands. Right. I remember, this wasn't my favorite memory of my dad, but you know, when I was a child, but saying, we were going to go to Six Flags or whatever. If you'd obey, well, I didn't know we were going to go to Six Flags, or I would have been better. I mean, what Israel has lost, right? If only you had paid attention to his commands, your peace would have been like a river, your righteousness like the waves of the sea. I mean, and this, Tim, this, and this is a new idea to me, and I'll still work with it, but I really like this definition of, it could have been the kingdom in the past, but it's going to be the kingdom in the future. These two words, peace and righteousness. Does that kind of, does that capture it all? I mean, this is what the future kingdom's going to be like. It's going to be a time of peace, and peace doesn't just mean no war. Peace is, it's the word in Hebrew, shalom. And righteousness. And you don't want one without the other. And you can't have one without the other. If only you'd obeyed, verse 19, you would have descendants like the sand. That doesn't mean it'll never happen. It just means it hasn't happened now. You don't have peace because you don't have peace. You have war because you have war. You don't have a lot of children because they're killed and captured. Leave Babylon. I end with this thought here. He's announcing, leave Babylon, flee from the Babylonians. So this is again tying into and tying up this idea of deliverance. I'm going to send Cyrus. I'm going to raise him up. He's going to be your deliverer. He's going to let you go. So when he does, flee Babylon, and come back to the promised land. And in verse 21, there's Exodus imagery. So it's the same sort of idea. It's a second Exodus. It's, I brought you out of Egypt once, you know, now I'm going to bring you out of Babylon. And I'm going to take care of you and provide for you. This is the theme of the book, theme of this chapter, trust God. I'm going to do this. Believe me. Don't doubt. Don't seek other gods.
Todd, this is a critical example, I think, though, for us today. Part of the presentations that I heard this last week up in Colorado Springs, one was on spiritual aging, and just the longer you walk, the more difficult it is sometimes to really grasp who God is for believers today. And you look at the data, the guys in their 30s that were on fire for the Lord, in their 50s are looking for a place to fish rather than because they missed it because of the hardness of heart issues. And so I think, you know, 1 Corinthians 10, these things are written as examples. I mean, we're supposed to get it. I mean, this is us. Israel is a picture of what happens if you don't pay attention. And it speaks clearly to us today, the same thing they're struggling with. God has said incredible things. He speaks in subtleties, so the people that want to hear it get it, the people that are approaching it very selfishly miss it.
Very good. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word, and it is an encouragement to us and a challenge. It is a rebuke when we do call ourselves by your name, but we don't walk in truth according to that. It is an encouragement to us to see that because you've been entirely faithful in the past, you will be entirely faithful in the future. And so strengthen us by this truth to be zealous for you, to be committed to obedience and faith. We want to walk each day in faith, and that doesn't come naturally. So do a good work by your Spirit through your word in us, that you would be glorified today and for all time. In Jesus' name we ask this. Amen.
Thank you, Todd. Just a couple quick things before we dismiss.